Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. In August 2025, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization held its 25th annual summit in Tianjin, China, with the country's leader, Xi Jinping, hosting representatives from more than 20 countries, including Russia's Vladimir Putin and India's Narendra Modi. The absence of the United States in this gathering of global leaders may tell us about how China is competing with the U.S. and building its own global order. To discuss China's strategic competition with the U.S. and how it is evolving under the Trump administration, in September 2025, I spoke to Professor Evan Medeiros, the Penner Family Chair in Asian Studies and the Kling Family Senior Fellow in U.S.-China Relations at Georgetown University. His research and teaching focuses on the international politics of East Asia, U.S.-China relations, and China's foreign and national security policies. Dr. Medeiros previously served for 6 years on the staff of the National Security Council as Director for China, Taiwan, and Mongolia, and then as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Asia. I started out by asking Professor Medeiros to outline his research and current work.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me. I'm Evan Medeiros, professor and Penner Family Chair in Asian Studies at Georgetown School of Foreign Service. I also have to say that I'm a very proud graduate of the LSE. I got my PhD here from the Department of International Relations in 2002. So it's a special pleasure to be back on campus and to be doing this podcast with you today.
Well, it's great to have you here, and thank you so much for joining us. So for my first question, at the time of this recording, we're around the 7 month or so mark of President Trump's second term. How would you describe China-U.S. relations at this point?
Well, we're at a very, very interesting moment in the U.S.-China relationship, but let me step back. The key to understanding the U.S.-China relationship is to separate the structural or long-term trends in the relationship from the cyclical or short-term trends in the relationship. The structural trends in the relationship, I think, are quite clear right now, which is we are now locked in a long-term geopolitical and arguably even ideological competition between the United States and China. So that's a competition where our interests diverge on questions of security and diplomacy, on economics and technology and ideas of both domestic governance and global governance. So that's the long-term structural trend. And I would say most analysts of U.S.-China relations across the political spectrum in the United States acknowledge and accept that we are in this phase of long-term competition. But that's very different than the cyclical trends. The cyclical trends being the particular choices of any administration, either in Beijing or in Washington. And so what's so interesting about this particular moment in the U.S.-China relationship is that President Trump appears to be pursuing an approach that some call strategic stabilization. In other words, trying to reduce the tension in the relationship and focus much more on deal making and even engagement between the United States and China. Just last week, President Trump had a phone call with Xi Jinping, and in that phone call, they outlined a series of interactions coming up that they both plan to meet at the APEC summit in South Korea. Then subsequently, Trump would travel to Beijing in early 2026, and that opens the door for Xi Jinping to potentially come to the United States later that year to attend the G20. So we may, in fact, be in a period of almost 12 months of the administration pursuing this strategic stabilization policy. Some people even refer to it as a calibration. Now, what's interesting is that that particular cyclical trend or that policy the Trump administration is pursuing is at such odds with the long-term or structural trend in the relationship. And so it immediately raises questions about whether this Trump approach is going to succeed, whether it's politically sustainable in the United States, because there is so much concern about long-term competition with China. Are we doing enough to invest in ourselves? Are we doing enough in technology competition? Are we preparing for potential conflict over Taiwan and other scenarios in East Asia? So it will be interesting to see how these two trends, the cyclical and the structural, sort themselves out in the next few months.
So tariffs have been a hallmark of Trump's return to office. How are these tariffs reshaping the wider world order? And what has been their specific impact on U.S.-China ties?
Well, on the U.S.-China relationship, they immediately prompted a period of tensions. We had a sort of tit-for-tat action-reaction function in the relationship where both sides impose over 100% tariffs on one another. And then we settled back down to the reality of about an average of 55% tariffs on China today. So that's a combination of tariffs from the first Trump administration, which the Biden team kept, combined with what Trump calls his new reciprocal tariffs, and then an additional 20% tariffs due to fentanyl. So that all adds up to 55%. And so right now, the tariff issue appears to be relatively stable in the U.S.-China relationship. In this new period that we're entering, this sort of strategic stabilization or recalibration, the question will be whether or not both sides can make enough progress to get that tariff level down. I think one of the most important dimensions of this sort of tariff negotiation between the U.S. and China was the fact that the Chinese used the American reliance on imports of rare earth elements and specifically heavy magnets as a point of leverage to get the administration to reduce the tariffs. So that in many ways opened a new arena for competition where the Chinese weaponized this very specific source of leverage that they had on the United States. Now, of course, the U.S. did the same in return. It started denying China access to certain types of aviation parts, certain types of software and tools necessary to make semiconductors. So effectively, both sides during this early phase of tit-for-tat tariff negotiation, they both identified choke point goods, services, and technologies, weaponized them. I think both sides recognized that this could go very bad very, very quickly. They were sort of at the brink of the precipice, so to speak, in the economic relationship. Both sides decided to pull back, which led to this status quo today. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not we go below that 55% tariff in this possible new era of stabilization that we're entering. But both sides seem sort of relatively stable. Now, of course, this has had a material impact on the U.S.-China trade relationship. We're just trading with each other less. It's starting to have an inflationary impact on the United States because the tariffs mean, simply put, Americans have to pay more at the store. When you go to big mega stores in the United States like Target or Walmart, goods cost more. When you go online on Amazon, goods cost more. And I think that that inflationary impact is only gaining momentum in the United States. And that's going to be very significant. In the wider world, what it's done is it has created further headwinds to globalization. And it has put the United States in a position where it appears to much of the world to be anti-trade. And so the Chinese have capitalized on it. It's presented the Chinese with an opportunity in which they can now claim the mantle of leadership of globalization, free trade, multilateralism. They see it as a great strategic opportunity. And the UN General Assembly is going on in New York this week. And when you look at the speeches of whether or not it's Xi Jinping or the premier of China, both of them are using Trump's promotion of tariffs and Trump's tariff bargaining as a way to generate geopolitical influence for themselves.
Just to follow up, you mentioned the sort of inflationary impact of the tariffs, and that sort of underscores the interrelationship between the Chinese and U.S. economies. Is there sort of a floor or a limit to how much the U.S. can use tariffs on China, given that interrelationship and given the complexity of their economies and how linked they are now?
Nobody knows where the floor is, or maybe a better way to think about it is what the ceiling is. In other words, is the U.S. prepared to impose more tariffs? And with Donald Trump, anything is possible. And certainly if the Chinese were to put further restrictions on rare earth exports, tariffs tend to be Trump's favorite tool of retaliation. So he may be prepared to do even more. Very difficult to predict what President Trump is going to do. But what's clear is that the American president likes tariffs and is prepared to use them if the Chinese cut off access to more critical equipment, materials, technologies that American companies need.
So in response to Trump's tariffs, we've also seen India's Narendra Modi's administration pivot closer towards China. Do you expect other governments to move closer to Beijing in response to U.S. tariffs?
Well, certainly that's the case. It depends who you're talking about. And so I think traditional American allies in Europe and Asia have not moved closer to Beijing for a whole variety of different reasons. In Europe, many of the economies, while frustrated with the American tariffs, have decided to cut a deal largely for national security reasons. In other words, they need to focus on consolidating American support for NATO and continuing to underwrite security for Europe as Europe faces a highly revisionist Russia that is sort of probing and testing for security vulnerabilities among allies in Europe. In East Asia, what you've seen is Japan, Korea, and Australia come to Washington and do their best to cut deals with Trump. So it's certainly frustrated and alienated countries. But more importantly, what it's done is with countries in the global south, India being an obvious example, another one being Brazil, it has damaged American relations with those countries and provided Beijing with sort of an open door to grow its influence with them. And the fact that Modi attended the big SCO summit is proximate evidence of that. The fact that Trump has sort of single-handedly led to the revitalized political support for President Lula in Brazil, simply in opposing the American tariffs, Lula's become even more popular. I think all of that is evidence of the damage these tariffs have done to American prestige, American influence in the world.
So in past work, you've talked about U.S.-China relations as strategic competition. What are the main axes of this competition now, and how stable is it?
My view is that the best way to think about strategic competition is that it occurs in four arenas: military national security competition, economic competition, third, technology competition, and then fourth, a competition of ideas. In other words, ideas about domestic governance, but also ideas about global governance. And in the global governance basket, it's incumbent on me to point out that Xi Jinping, in recent weeks, right after the SCO summit, the big military parade, put forward another new initiative, a global governance initiative that tries to draw a contrast to the traditional American conception of promoting a liberal rules-based order. So I think U.S.-China competition occurs in these four arenas. And by competition, I mean very simply that our interests diverge. And as our interests have been diverging, and I think this really started accelerating in a very significant way under Xi Jinping, because he was so much more active in pursuing Chinese interests, and because he was so much more willing to sort of push the boundaries of Chinese foreign policy. He was much more willing to take risk, to assume friction in China's relationships with countries, including the United States, in order to advance Chinese interests. And we've seen that play out on issues like the South China Sea. We've seen that play out on issues like Taiwan, for example. And I see the trajectory of competition only intensifying in these four areas, even despite the fact that we might be entering into this period of strategic stabilization or recalibration or reduce tensions, because when you look at American long-term interests and America's view of its role in the world and Chinese interests and China's view of its role in the world, I see a greater degree of divergence than convergence.
And thinking about these four arenas, are there any that we should be considering more closely than another, any we should be more worried about, or are they all sort of fairly equal in terms of how they're progressing?
Well, I think that we're in a very early stage of the strategic competition between the United States and China. There's a very 1950s quality to what's going on. And by 1950s, Chris, what I mean is the early stages in the U.S.-Soviet strategic competition, which we, of course, called a Cold War. And so because we're in this early stage, both sides are very much exploring the boundaries of competition. Where are we going to compete? How are we going to compete? And the Cold War, very quickly, it became clear that the Cold War was largely an ideological competition with a major military component, which led to massive American and European buildup in Central Europe as Europe was divided. I think that we're still in the process of determining what the major arenas of competition are going to be. Right now, we're competing in all these four baskets simultaneously. And as I said, I think they're all intensifying. But one dimension of this sort of four-arena competition that's important to point out for your listeners is that, unlike previous periods in the U.S.-China relationship, there is such a overlap in these areas. In other words, competition over national security has expressions in technology policy. Competition in technology has dimensions of a competition of ideas, and so on and so forth. And because there's such an overlap, a mixing of the different dimensions of competition, it's going to be very, very difficult for either side to compartmentalize competition. The US and the Soviets were able to do that to some degree and find areas where they could cooperate, even on national security. Famously, during the height of the Cold War in the 1960s, the US and the Soviets were both big advocates of nuclear nonproliferation, which ultimately led to the 1968 Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the NPT. We don't see that yet in the US-China relationship. I see simultaneous competition that is very, very overlapping. I think it's going to be very, very difficult to compartmentalize. So it's hard to say yet what those sort of major arenas are going to be and what the implications are going to be. And as a result of that, the fact that we have four areas of competition is intensifying, that it's going to be hard to compartmentalize, and the fact that both sides are using more competitive strategies in all of these areas, I think the risk for the competition or the stability of the competition is pretty weak.
So the Tianjin Summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in August this year was the largest in the organization's history, with Xi Jinping hosting leaders and representatives from more than 20 countries. What does the scale of this gathering tell us about China's ambitions for the SCO and its place in the global order?
This is a great question, Chris, because I think it highlights one of the most interesting dimensions of Chinese foreign and security policy, which has been a perennial long-term research interest of mine throughout my career. And that, as a longtime watcher of China, there was nothing about China's ambitions that surprised me, because as a careful watcher of Xi Jinping, one of the most interesting things to me has been that he's been quite clear and quite transparent about his ambitions, wanting to position China at the center of international politics, wanting to grow China's both regional and global power and influence, wanting China to have a greater role in shaping rules, norms, and institutions globally, and shaping them in a direction that serve Chinese interests. So I think China's been very clear about its ambitions in that regard. What's interesting is China also has been clear about the fact that it doesn't want to replace the United States one for one, doesn't want to become a global policeman. Xi Jinping's China wants to be at the center of international politics, but doesn't want to assume all of the responsibilities that the United States has. But what was most striking to me was not the clarity of the ambition captured in the pageantry of the SCO and the military parade, but was that Xi Jinping was so willing to flaunt to the rest of the world the fact that that ambition had a clear anti-US and anti-Western dimension to it. In other words, Xi Jinping was very happy to stand up on the rostrum in front of Tiananmen Gate with Putin, with Kim Jong-un, with Lukashenko, and other authoritarian leaders, and clearly say, we have a very different view of international relations than the Americans in the Western world. There are alternatives to the liberal rules-based order. I, Xi Jinping, have no problem being very public in my association with these guys around me. And why you in the West have your allies and build up your alliances to constrain and contain me, Xi Jinping, I can do the same thing. And here are the guys that I'm hanging out with. And he clearly had absolutely no compunction about projecting that image to the world. Very, very quickly followed by a parade of some very sophisticated military equipment, including new types of intercontinental ballistic missiles and drone systems that military analysts in the West had not seen before.
So thinking about that Victory Day parade that featured both Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un alongside Xi Jinping, should Washington read the parade primarily as a deterrence signaling to the US and its allies? Or is it more about domestic legitimation for Xi? Or is it perhaps an effort to normalize China's expanding military role?
I think it's option D, all of the above. As I said, Xi Jinping's ambitions are not surprising to me. Of course, he's been devoting a lot of resources, both political and material, to PLA modernization in recent years. But what was striking was just the breadth and the depth of military systems that he was prepared to put in the military parade. And so it was meant to send multiple signals to multiple audiences. But as I said, it wasn't the scale of the ambition that surprised me. It's the fact that he was so willing to be public and really flaunt that in front of the international community. And right after the SCO summit and the Victory Day parade, you have Xi Jinping announce this new global governance initiative.
So how are U.S. regional allies like Japan and South Korea and Australia likely to interpret the Victory Day parade? Is it possible it could shift their alignment choices?
I don't think it will shift their alignment choices. And in fact, all three governments have been very, very clear that they're interested in holding the United States close. And that's reflected in how they've responded to the tariff. Nobody likes the tariffs. And most countries feel that they're highly unjustified. But that didn't stop policymakers in Tokyo, Seoul, Canberra from coming to Washington and striking a deal with Trump. In the case of South Korea and Japan, that's accepting a 15% tariff and promising to invest hundreds of billions of dollars in the United States. So basically give Trump what he wants to ensure the alliance stayed strong. And I think that was a reflection of their anxiety about growing Chinese power and Chinese ambitions, their anxiety about frictions in their relationship with the United States. So it was about sort of locking in the United States and keeping Trump as close as possible. So I think that the prospect for them shifting alignments is really off the table.
More of a speculative question. Is there any circumstance, thinking about the global governance that China is trying to build and thinking about the US's tendencies under Trump, are there any circumstances where these regional allies like Japan, like South Korea would think about moving closer to China? Or is that just completely off the table for them?
So I think that those countries are not a good test of the reactions to the Trump administration, because these are countries that are so close to the United States and have been. America has over 50,000 troops deployed in Japan, close to 30,000 in South Korea, growing number in Australia. We now have this new AUKUS agreement, US, UK, Australia, to deploy and ultimately build nuclear submarines together. So these are countries that are sort of all in on the United States. So they're not really the right tests of Trump. It's really countries that have a more arm's length relationship with the United States. I mean, you have two other allies in East Asia, the Philippines and Thailand, who might take greater umbrage at Trump's tariffs and might think about pulling back a little bit from the United States. I think the situation that really concerns me is one in which Trump takes an action, or the United States, any administration takes an action that signals a lack of commitment to allies and partners. That could be in Europe, that could be in Asia. It could also be related to Taiwan. And so it's not that countries would pivot toward China, bandwagon with them, to use the political science term, but rather that countries, I think, would pursue self-help policies that look much more like building up their own military capabilities. In the case of Japan and Korea, potentially developing nuclear weapons, strengthening their military ties among each other.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
In a foreign affairs article earlier this year, you wrote, "In the abstract, drawing Russia away from China to shift the balance of power in favor of the United States sounds appealing. In reality, the idea is a bad one. Why is this a bad idea, and what might be the consequences of such a move?"
Well, I wrote that article when Trump and Putin were close. Now there clearly has been a falling out, and Trump is quite upset at Putin's unwillingness to pursue a ceasefire with Ukraine. So in many ways, the whole idea of a reverse Kissinger pulling Russia away from China seems to be off the table for now. But the reason we wrote the article was because we were hearing in Washington that there were senior Trump officials that were exploring this idea. I wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs with my friend and colleague Mike McFaul, a professor at Stanford. We worked together in the Obama National Security Council. He was senior director for Russia and I was director for China. And what Mike and I argue in the piece is that it would be a bad idea because A, Putin would never believe it. B, if we tried and failed, that would probably be worse than never trying at all. And there's very little that the United States could offer Russia or Putin, even if he did believe it, that would exceed what the Chinese offered. So it would end up being a failed initiative that would cost the United States dearly, would alienate pretty much all of our allies in Europe, and ultimately, at the end of the day, it wouldn't work. So it would be a very costly venture. It wouldn't be particularly effective. And undergirding this entire argument is the belief that the ties between Russia and China are just so substantial. And they're based on a convergence of strategic interests, in particular, their desire to diminish substantially American influence in the world, growing economic cooperation, the fact that the Chinese are getting access to advanced Russian military technologies, they're getting access to oil and gas at highly, highly discounted prices, and significantly, simply put, the personal relationship between Xi and Putin. I think they're very close. They have similar views, similar skepticism of the United States. And I think as long as Putin and Xi are on the scene, that will sustain that relationship in a significant way. The final point I'll make on this, Chris, is in the history of American foreign policy, one of the big mistakes that American policymakers made in the 60s was discounting the significance of the Sino-Soviet split. For most of the 60s, even though we were years from the Sino-Soviet split of 1959-1960, many American policymakers simply didn't believe that it had happened. And I worry that the United States is at risk of making the opposite mistake. We underestimated the degree of the split in the 60s. I worry we're underestimating the degree of the convergence today.
So in your 2024 article, The Delusion of Peak China, you argue that claims China has plateaued are misguided. Could you talk about your argument and why you think this still holds?
Well, there are many facets of the argument, so I encourage people to read the article. But the article begins by simply prosecuting the concept of peak itself. What does it mean for China to have peak? Just because its GDP is declining, does that mean that China does not represent an economic challenge to the United States? My argument was, yes, China's GDP may no longer grow at 8, 9, 10%. But that doesn't mean that China doesn't represent an economic challenge or a technological challenge to the United States. But even if I did grant that the Chinese economy peaked, whatever that may mean, does that mean its military has peaked? Does that mean that China doesn't represent a technological challenge to the United States? So my argument was essentially that the United States needs to move away from these kinds of conversations and look much more at how precisely China is challenging us in the four arenas that I mentioned earlier, and focus U.S. policymaking on ensuring that the U.S. at home and abroad has the capabilities for long-term competition. Because the reality is China faces a variety of both immediate and long-term economic challenges. And even if the Chinese economy sort of grinds down to 2 to 3% growth, it still is going to remain substantial. It will be significant economically and geopolitically to countries all over the world. And China has enormous domestic capabilities that it can use to prosecute this long-term competition with the United States militarily, economically, and technologically.
In the same article, you note that Xi cites color revolutions as evidence of Western interference. Do you see this as a genuine concern about regime stability, a political instrument for domestic and international audiences, or perhaps both?
Again, I'll choose D, all of the above, but I think it's important to take very, very seriously the degree to which the party is very focused on its long-term legitimacy and survival. As a China specialist, what has struck me is the consistent preoccupation when I read CCP documents, how party members talk to one another, how at the end of the day, everything seems to come back to CCP legitimacy. And any statement or policy action by the United States or any country that threatens the CCP's legitimacy or could create risks for political stability in China are treated as deadly serious by the CCP. And one of the things that I found challenging when I worked in government was that it felt sort of impossible to effectively reassure the CCP about anything. I worked at the White House at the National Security Council from 2009 to 2015. And you may recall, or your listeners may recall, that there was something called the Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong that starts in 2014 that very much unnerved the CCP. And they believed that the United States was secretly behind fomenting this instability. Of course, the U.S. had no role in this, and it was about a sort of youth rebellion, younger generation who wanted better quality of life. They wanted more political freedoms. And I remember when President Obama was sitting down and talking with Xi Jinping during this, he specifically told him, directly person to person. This was not some secret CIA plot to destabilize or split China. So you really need to stop that propaganda. And afterwards, it was pretty clear that even that leader-to-leader assurance didn't really have any long-term impact on Chinese perceptions. I mean, I remember reading a Chinese article at one point that talked about how the fact that many of the student protesters used iPhones, obviously made by Apple, an American company, was just further evidence that the United States was behind fomenting the umbrella revolution.
So in your piece, U.S.-China Relations for the 2030s, Toward a Realistic Scenario for Coexistence, you suggest that U.S.-China relations have moved beyond engagement to anti-engagement frameworks. Could you talk about this progression in diplomatic relations?
Well, in that particular piece, what I do is I look at a whole variety of possible futures. So I'm trying to forecast the future of the relationship and look at different scenarios for how the U.S.-China relationship could evolve. So when I talked about anti-engagement, that was one among many, many scenarios. The reality is that even though we're in an era of strategic competition, engagement, if you define it as simply Americans and Chinese at all levels talking with one another, even at the government-to-government level, negotiating about a state visit or negotiating about the future of TikTok or commercial deals, that engagement or dialogue is always going to be a feature of the U.S.-China relationship. And that's not to deny the competitive dimensions of the relationship. It's not a sort of subtle way to sort of pull punches that I think that we shouldn't engage in intense competition. It's an acknowledgement of the fact that even as we compete with China, even as that competition will intensify, that we need to make sure that it doesn't break out into hot war. This, in many ways, was the core challenge that the Americans and the Soviets face during the first Cold War, was how to ensure that hot war doesn't break out. And I think in many ways, as the strategic competition evolves, it will have different phases in different periods, just like the Cold War did. And I think that we're entering into a different phase, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, because the Trump administration appears to be trying to lower tensions and pursue strategic stabilization. And so they might raise the level of engagement as a way to try to manage tensions in the relationship. But the reality is that we always need to be talking with each other. The question is, are we talking about the right issues? And are we coming up with effective mechanisms and frameworks in those conversations for managing the strategic competition so it doesn't sort of boil over into hot war? One of the issues that American scholars and policymakers are debating is whether we need a Cuban Missile Crisis-like event in the U.S.-China relationship for both sides to recognize that restraint and strategic restraint is going to be necessary to manage this era of strategic competition. Nobody wants a Cuban Missile Crisis-like event, but we're very early on in the strategic competition. Neither side, especially the Chinese side, appears willing to adopt any degree of strategic restraint, seeing it as a signal of weakness. But that's a very, very dangerous pathway to go down, because as competition intensifies, the risks of an accident or miscalculation or a crisis that escalates, those risks are only growing.
Thinking about that evolving, intensifying competition, what do you think the chances are that China is able to achieve whatever its vision is for global governance? Is the U.S. going to be able to effectively tackle that?
I think it's one of the central challenges for American foreign policy. Both Republicans and Democrats will face this challenge. What is clear is that American policymakers across the political spectrum need to do a better job at home and abroad of articulating why a rules-based order and why liberal values serve the interests of both the American public as well as countries all over the world. And we're in an era where there's an enormous amount of criticism of globalization. And that's why many countries, including the United States, especially the United States, have clearly stepped back from globalization. And that's one of the reasons why Trump has pursued such a tariff-intensive foreign policy. But I think the United States needs to do a better job of articulating why these rules, norms, and institutions are in the interests of other countries in a world where the United States has so clearly stepped back from its traditional role as supporting a rules-based order. It provides China with a very easy opportunity to present itself as the leader of globalization and multilateralism when it's not. The Chinese operate a very mercantilist and protectionist economy. But the Trump administration has provided them, I think, with this very substantial strategic opening to put forward these new initiatives, global security initiative, global civilizational initiative, global economic initiative, that are really just ways of trying to put China more at the center of international affairs in a way that will serve Chinese interests, but not really serve the interests of supporting a rules-based global order.
And just before we finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, that's very nice of you. I always welcome an opportunity to promote my own work. This past spring, I wrote an article with Andrew Polk from Trivium, where we looked at what we called China's new economic weapons. So the ways in which China has built up a series of tools like its weaponization of export controls as a way for China to engage more effectively in economic competition. And we outlined why China did this and how China did it. And what was interesting is how many of these tools have been used by Beijing in their sort of trade war with the Trump administration. I've just started working on a new piece with Bates Gill, a very prominent longtime China watcher, where we're looking at what we call the new strategic triangle, which is US-China-EU relations, and trying to understand how these three actors interact with one another. And we assert that there is a puzzle at the heart of their interaction, which is during periods of transatlantic tensions, why that has not driven the EU closer to China. And in fact, in some instances of transatlantic tensions, US-EU or US-European cooperation in China has actually grown, which is not what history or theory would tell you would happen. So we're trying to understand the precise contours of the dynamic and then explain it. So for listeners, watch out for that publication in the months ahead.
Thanks so much. And all the other articles and pieces we've talked about today will also be linked to in our show notes. Just remains me to say, Professor Evan Medeiros, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
Professor Evan Medeiros is the Penner Family Chair in Asian Studies and the Kling Family Senior Fellow in U.S.-China Relations at Georgetown University. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Evan Medeiros for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fata. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @lse_us, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. Helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.